So that made it very clear to me that this whole, I mean, one of the obvious kind of justifications that have been bandied about in the press and by the government is that, you know, we've already got so many alerts and warnings of terrorist attacks coming in. You know, we just can't figure out what is correct and what's not. It's too much. And that report kind of just cut through that and said, well, no, you had good reason to take this information seriously, and you did. And you intensified surveillance as a result, which would suggest that having received that, they would have known that that style of attack, Project Bojinka, was now being prepared and was going to be implemented. And any surveillance done after that would have been taking that into account. So any information received wouldn't have just been, okay, you know, now we've got Zacharias Moussaoui, who's, you know, he's, you know, we've got an FBI investigation going on where he doesn't want to even know how to land a Boeing jet, and French are telling us that he's a terrorist, and we're like, no, it doesn't matter, we don't have anything to assess this against. Well, they did, and but they didn't do anything. And so that those bits of information, you put them together, and then a kind of more coherent picture starts to emerge of this administration and this intelligence community receiving warnings, and someone somewhere up top kind of manipulating things and not allowing investigators on the ground to do their jobs. And there was one other report which really struck me. It was from Newsweek, and it was issued only a few days or few weeks after 9/11 in September. And there was another report from Newsweek again a few months later confirming the same thing. That on 10 September, the day before the attacks, top Pentagon officials cancelled their travel plans for the next day over security concerns. And that's specifically mentioned in the report. And Newsweek actually asked the question that, you know, what information was available to these officials and why was it not passed on to the people who were aboard those planes on 9/11? You know, and this should become an issue of controversy on Capitol Hill, and it hasn't. And I think that's normally what I actually do in my interviews. I just present that and say, okay.
Yeah, and you say in your book that a few other random people somehow knew, like Salman Rushdie and the mayor of, they somehow knew not to fly that day.
Yeah, because Salman, I mean, it was the Times of London that reported Salman Rushdie had got a warning from the FAA that there was something going to happen within that week. And it was interesting because the report actually asked Salman Rushdie whether security had been raised for the general public to the same level as for him. And no, the answer was no. It was just for him. Which is weird, you know. And it's interesting because Rushdie is always, after what happened with Khomeini in Iran and all the rest of it, and the death sentence and all that, he's basically constantly under the protection of British intelligence now. And they always make sure that there's nothing going on. So anything that he would have known would have passed through British intelligence. So then you have to ask, what did they know? And if Salman Rushdie was good enough to protect, and they knew something was going to happen, why didn't that have any implication for the general public? And San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown. I mean, it was the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, that reported. Again, it was not long after 9/11. They reported that I think it was on the morning of 11th September. He was warned not to travel. No, it was the day before September. He was warned not to travel next day to New York. Because I think he had a flight, and he's basically not revealed who it is exactly that gave him that warning. He said something like it's his security person at the airport. It's very ambiguous, and so we're left with this kind of picture of why are these certain apparently random officials being told that something is going to happen, and how come the general public is not being told? And it's not just, I mean, John Ashcroft as well, as of, I think it was July 2001, he was flying, he stopped flying commercial airliners, and he started only flying private jet, and that was reported by CBS News. And the reason he did that was apparently because of an FBI threat assessment. And he was asked, why, you know, did you know about what was contained in this assessment? You know, what was the information available that led you to do this? And he said, oh, I don't know. You know, they just gave me the threat assessment. They told me I shouldn't fly. You know, and this is the guy who's basically the head of the FBI, you know, head of law enforcement, and he's saying that I don't know, I don't care. It's really, really strange. And there's this pattern there of high-level officials. I mean, now we've got Pentagon officials as well. All of them kind of knowing something's going to happen and making sure that they're protected and not really caring about the general public. And even if we're not going to take this overarching conspiratorial view of that, which in my view, it does seem very suspicious. But even if we don't, we have this really clear case of, one, knowledge that something is going to happen, and two, complete negligence, you know, because you just don't care, you know. And what is the difference between that and complicity, really, you know, in real terms? It isn't much difference at all. You're basically letting it happen. So I don't think you can have, in this case, you can have this scale of negligence and say it's benign. And looking at the way that investigations were being blocked, and the number of people coming out, and there are more anonymous people coming out as well who are saying that we had investigations blocked. I mean, there's a conservative magazine called The New American, which interviewed three anonymous FBI agents, and they may have been connected to shippers, I'm not sure, who basically said that they believed that information was basically just being short-stopped from Washington, and they were just manipulating the flow of information. And one of the things that one of them commented, I think this guy was a former FBI counter-terrorist investigator, and he was commenting as an expert, and he basically said, well, look, we had FBI going to the flight schools where the training had occurred literally hours after the attacks. And they had photos of the hijackers, they had names, they knew where they were training. And he simply said, this kind of information, you just can't you can't develop that in a few hours. You know, this was an ongoing operation, and information was there, it was sitting in the files. Now, that's the only explanation for why they acted so fast. And it looks to me like there was this systematic block there, which did exist. And there may have been several reasons for that. I mean, I believe that they knew that there was going to be some kind of attack. And whether they knew the exact precise nature of the attack really isn't that important for the implications of that. But I think they knew the World Trade Center was probably going to be hit. I think they knew the method of the attack. And I think they basically put the brakes on.
Who are you referring to by they?
They, as in the U.S. intelligence community, the Bush administration, the key members of the cabinet, I think they were in the know, you know. And it's quite interesting that in the official inquiry that was going ahead, led by the House and the Senate, the material that they've declassified, some of it has been very useful. And a lot of it has actually exposed some of the lies, previous lies of the administration, such as this whole issue of planes being used as bombs. I mean, they've come out with piles and piles of data, you know, that we knew this then, and we knew this then, and we knew this then, and it's just come out. But again, they've got that claim that we haven't assessed it properly. But what is interesting is that they've kept classified two pieces of information. One of them, which is significant to what I'm talking about now, is they've kept classified which of this information was actually received by the President and by the White House. We have not been told how much the White House cabinet knew, which is, one would think, would be one of the key points of an inquiry, is to find out. I mean, that was what the Democrats were supposedly calling for. You know, we want to know, you know, what they knew, when they knew it. That was the slogan. And now we're not being told, we're just being told that we want to investigate the structural problems with the intelligence community. And we don't have a clue what the President knew. And it's really funny because the actual documents themselves, they've got where they're from, which department they're from, and who it's being sent to. And they've literally just blanked out the place where it might be the President or it might be someone else. They've blanked it out. And there's piles of this paper, and all this stuff has been blanked out on each one, and you're thinking, okay, how much did they know? How much information did they receive? And they haven't declassified even minor things, like the August hijack warning, which was supposed to be like this general warning of a hijacking given to Bush at his ranch. They haven't even declassified that. I mean, Dick Cheney came out and said that, well, you know, we didn't want to declassify that because, you know, if we do that, we're giving out the crown jewels. That was what he said, because, you know, we might reveal all the methods and the sources, and we don't want to do that. And when Dick Cheney himself said that, when they was asked, why aren't you going to, you know, what is the big deal about this report? And he said, well, it's not a big deal. He basically goes, it's just bits and pieces of information. It was very general, and a lot of it is kind of a rehash of old stuff. And, you know, it didn't contain anything new. And so we've got these two positions taken, you know. One of them was that, yeah, you know, we weren't really given anything, it was just a hijacking. And at the same time, oh no, it's got the crown jewels there. And, you know, so like, there's really clear contradictions here as to why they're not telling us what they were told. And putting it all together, it does seem that they may have known a lot more than they're letting on. And if they actually let that out into the public, people will be very angry about what did these guys know and why didn't they act.
You're listening to Nafiz Ahmed, author of War on Freedom. My colleague Audrey Burns and I interviewed Ahmed in February of 2003 in England. In this excerpt of the interview, Ahmed articulates reasons why a 9/11 type attack could have proven beneficial to the strategic priorities of the Bush administration.
If we go back to the Cold War and before the Cold War, there is this ongoing continuity which people keep forgetting. And I think we have to look to people like Noam Chomsky to remind ourselves of what this essential strategy is that has existed. I mean, it's not just the United States, it's the British as well. And together they are heavily involved in what they see to be recreating a world order and shaping world order for the benefits of Western Europe mainly, and particularly the United States, with Britain having played this junior role. And this is really clear from declassified documents that have come out, not just within the United States, but also from the Foreign Office here. And what we see is this, since then, I mean, while we had decolonization, at this very same time we had these officials talking about the need to maintain their access to the colonies, you know, and to maintain control. And with the British Empire declining, then we also had people in the State Department talking about how, well, we need to replace this empire with, and they'd quote, a Pax Americana, you know. And the British, seeing the inevitable decline, said, okay, you have the Pax Americana and we'll be your next buddies, you know, we'll be your underling. And we have the reports from the, I think it's from the Foreign Office, basically talking about how Britain would then play this role as a junior partner in this orbiting around the American axes. And they talk about this grand strategy of basically ensuring their control over very strategic regions in order to maintain their overall world dominance, and expanding that into this, generally this what they've admitted to be like an empire. And we find that this is a continual thing. Like in the 1990s, we had these documents released from the Pentagon, defense planning guidance. These were authored by, in the early 1990s, Dick Cheney was heavily involved in authoring these, and in the latest one, he's been heavily involved. Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, other members of the current administration, and people who are not in the current administration as well, were involved in authoring these things. And these, again, just confirm exactly the same things that were talked about then. This need for the United States to establish this global preeminence. This is a term which is used quite commonly in these documents. And to prevent any other power from even aspiring to playing a greater role in world affairs. You know, everyone has to stay down. And it's basically this almost absolute control, absolute power. And then I think what really kind of is the last nail in the coffin for me. There was a document which was published, I don't know if it was released, I think it was kept very much secret in 97 to 98. There was a think tank called the Project for a New American Century. I don't know if you've heard of this. And the people involved in that are the very same people who are in this administration: Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Bush's brother Jeb, I mean, he's the governor of Florida, other people, Louis Libby, various other people, even the special envoy to Afghanistan, Zalkin Saz or something, I can't remember his name, he was involved as well. All these cronies in the current administration were involved in this think tank, and they sponsored a study before the current administration even came to power called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And this is a really, really enlightening document, because it literally, you have this blueprint there for everything that is happening now. And you can actually, I think the website is www.newamericancentury.org, and I think you can actually go there and see it online. I read an article talking about the first time I heard of it was in a Scottish newspaper called the Sunday Herald, and they described it as basically this secret blueprint for world domination. And it actually specifically mentions countries like Iraq, It mentions Iran, Syria. It talks about the need for regime change in China. You know, I mean, regime change in China. I mean, that's a lot, you know. And they talk about a whole host of really crazy things. And one of the things they mention is this thing about Iraq. And they talk about how the need to establish an American presence, an American force presence in the Persian Gulf region, and that this need transcends the issue of Saddam Hussein, which is very important, because now we have this whole thing about Saddam's done this, Saddam's done that, and Saddam's got weapons of mass destruction. And then we've got this study commissioned by the people in the current administration who are saying, well, going into the Gulf transcends the issue of Saddam Hussein and his weapons or all the rest of it. It's not about that. It's about establishing control. So there is this overall grand strategy there, which is about establishing this kind of, keep basically maintaining the power and extending it, and targeting regions such as Iraq, which obviously are heavy in energy resources, is a really crucial part of that. I mean, if you control, we've got an oil-based economy now, world economy. If you control the oil, if you control the flow of the oil, then you're able to control the prices, you're able to manipulate them, and essentially you can therefore manipulate the world economy. So going into Iraq, going into other regions of the world, where they perceive there to be a lot of energy resources and things like that, is really a key part of their policy.
Can you talk about some of the other sort of evidence that some people must have known about what's going to happen, in some of the specifics that you talk about in your book, like the stock trades and that sort of thing?
Actually, there is something interesting about the document that I mentioned from the Project for a New American Century, because in the same document, it actually uses this term about envisaging the possibility of a new Pearl Harbor. That's a quote. And they talk about how such an event would be the opportunity of ages, which essentially the impression you got was that would provide them with an ability to carry out all these plans by establishing this mindset amongst the American people. And to me, that was really astounding, finding out that that was in there, you know. And that's actually become almost reported in the mainstream. John Pilger did a piece on it, and I think it was either the London Mirror or it was in the New Statesman, both of which are, they've got a lot of clout in the UK. So this stuff is now coming out, and what's interesting is that Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor to Carter, he had actually talked about a very similar thing in his book, in his 97 study for the Council on Foreign Relations. And he talked about, he went through this whole process of outlining this grand strategy for the United States. And one of the things he mentioned is the possibility of this Pearl Harbor style attack, creating this consciousness in the United States of an external threat to America, which could then be used to kind of help project American power abroad, etc. And so I think what's important to look at there is that we have this general plan or general concept amongst various policy planners, many of whom are now instrumental in the current administration, who are basically saying, we imagined the concept of there being another Pearl Harbor type attack on the United States. And then suddenly, by coincidence, we have this attack which takes place and now is being used to justify this war on terror, which is in reality this war, which is all of a sudden from moving from Al-Qaeda, let's go to Saddam Hussein now, you know, go back into Iraq where Bush's dad was in and failed to really get there. You know, we find this really strange continuity. And I think it's really hard for anybody with some coming from a slightly rational perspective to say, that's a coincidence. You know, if you want to be rational, then it does seem really clear that, okay, somebody thought something was going to happen a long time ago and was thinking, let's exploit this, you know, let's exploit this and make use of it and implement our plans as soon as we can. So that provides a good context to then look at the specific warnings that they received. And you mentioned the stock trades. And Michael Ruppert, I think, was probably the most... the guy who provided the most incisive and concise analysis of what happened. I mean, basically, within a week prior to the 9/11 attacks, we had intensive speculation on the stocks. People were basically purchasing put options, which is essentially a bet. It's like a bet that a stock will fall in price. And people were basically purchasing these options on very specific things, on the American Airlines and United Airlines, which were obviously the airlines that were hijacked on 9/11. They were also purchasing stocks on firms which had huge offices in the World Trade Center, such as Morgan and Stanley, and other firms, I can't remember their names. And so what it showed is that, and what investigators subsequently believed, is that this intensive speculation showed that somebody knew about the attacks and was attempting to make a profit from them by obviously anticipating that the attacks would have drastically damaged the economy and drastically affect the stocks, those particular stocks, and make them drop in price so they could make a profit of that. And what Michael Ruppert really, what was the specific thing that I think he talked about, is that the CIA has a mechanism for monitoring stock trading via the use of Promise software, PROMIS. And there's a lot of controversy about that, the use of that software, where it came from, what's happening to it now, who's got it. But he documents in detail using various sources, and including one of the journalists who works with him interviewed a CIA spokesperson, Tom Crispell. Basically, the result of the evidence they compiled was that the CIA does maintain this ability to monitor stock trading. And they don't operate in the United States, because it's illegal to do it in the United States. They operate outside the United States. But they have this ability, and which suggests that basically that they were monitoring these stock trades, and they would have picked up on the very anomalous trading that occurred just prior to 9/11, and that this suggests that they may have actually known that this was one warning, that they should have known that something was going to happen via the airlines to the World Trade Center, literally just a few days prior to 9/11. So Ruppert really draws this overall conclusion, and he also brought together a few other bits and pieces of information. And then he says, this seems like CIA foreknowledge.
I mean, I know that following stock trading isn't illegal. How is this illegal? And then a second question, does his report reveal who made these trades, and what makes this illegal? And you know.
I mean, stock monitoring, the stock trading itself isn't illegal. There are civilian bodies which do that. I mean, there's a Financial Services Authority here in the UK which does that. Even Echelon, the satellite surveillance system I mentioned, has been reported to monitor stock trading. There are other authorities as well, I think, in the States which monitor stock trading. But either way, there are civilian bodies which do it, and there are also, there's intelligence bodies which do it as well. But what is illegal is the use of this software, Promise, because the software is actually very, very specialized, and it's not just used for stock trading, it's used for a whole host of things which I can't even remember now. A lot to do with... It's a lot to do with monitoring. It's a lot to do with surveillance, basically, to put it in a very generalized term. And because I don't have knowledge of the issue, I shouldn't really go into it anymore. But that is apparently illegal to use. That software, they're not allowed to use it in the United States. But Tom Crispell, the CIA guy I mentioned, he confirmed that they use it outside the States. And what was the question you asked in relation to that?
Do they know who is responsible for this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they say they don't know. They said that they thought it was Al-Qaeda or someone. But I think the nature of the trading itself is enough to suggest that whoever was involved was very sophisticated. And, you know, it's not like stock trading is something new to them. They understand American society. And they're very familiar with this kind of trading and this kind of the various economic structures in the States, and which shares to buy, and which companies do this and do that. They're very familiar with this, which would suggest they're not just a bunch of ragtag, you know, Afghans living in a cave, you know, which is a bit unlikely when you think about it at face value. But what's actually happened so far, I think the last report I read on it was actually in the year 2002. basically saying that the investigation so far is continuing, but hasn't really found anything, and they're still proceeding. And now we've had absolutely nothing coming out about what happened, which is interesting because the Securities and Exchange Commission released very momentarily a list of all the companies which had their stocks meddled with prior to 9/11. And this list of companies was basically released to the public for about literally a few hours or a day or something, and they put it on a website. Immediately it was taken down. The FBI and US intelligence tried to get rid of it, get it down. And it was managed to... It's still bits of pieces is still available because I think a couple of journalists just pulled it off the net, saved it, and then have just been dishing the information out. And I've never actually seen the full report. I've only managed to see a few companies listed by people who've reported on it, who've reported from somewhere else. So I've only seen second-hand stuff. But looking at that list of companies, someone who's got enough resources and enough expertise, and you'd probably need a team of researchers to do it, would be able to look at the trades going on in these companies and actually trace them back. And it wouldn't take them too long, but trace them back to people who were actually involved and actually did the trades. So then it leads you to ask the question, why did they not allow that to be public information? Why are they trying to hide this? And knowing that this would be, anybody who had the resources would be able to then do it themselves and try and look. And Michael Ruppert has actually tried to do it. He's actually called for people to donate. He said, I think they need a couple of grand in order for them to actually get the team together to do it. And he hasn't been able to do it. But anybody could do it. And they've blocked people from doing that. And to date, we've been told nothing about the investigation, which is very, very strange because it's not really a big issue tracking stock trades and finding out who was involved. And there were a couple of reports which came out in the year 2002 from the Washington Post and New York Times about a particular guy, which I think really kind of blows the whole thing open. And this guy was he's an Arab guy. I don't think that actually has an implication for what he did, but he was a stock advisor. I think he was based in New York, I'm not sure. Either Washington or New York, something like that. And on 10 September, he sold all his stock in something, I can't remember. And it was at some firm where he did it. And the guy who had actually helped him to sell it was suspicious enough after 9/11 to think, okay, why did he sell all his shares at this time? The day before the attacks occurred, I think this is something dodgy, I'm going to go and call the FBI. So he called the FBI. The FBI got in touch with him, investigated him. He's now, I don't know what's happened recently, but the reports at that time, he was being investigated by the FBI for having advanced knowledge of the attacks. And the guy who was prosecuting him was a government prosecutor who was actually involved in the investigation into the anomalous trading in 9/11. And he accused him. He said, this guy has advanced warning. And it doesn't end there, because I don't actually believe this guy may have had advance warning, because this guy had a record of corrupt activity on the stock trades, which he would actually do based on knowledge received from various contacts he had in the FBI. I think the reports mentioned he had four contacts. Two of them were active, and two of them were former FBI people. And they had established this ongoing relationship over a period of years where the FBI people would give him information, say, on a company that they were investigating which was committed various acts of fraud or something. He would then leak that information in order to damage the company's reputation, and he'd watch the stock slide, and he would make sure that he sold his shares or whatever. He'd do the appropriate thing to make sure he made a profit out of that. And this relationship was there, and he had established this relationship with these four FBI people. And so which leads me to think, well, on 10 September, was he just acting within the same capacity, getting information from people inside the FBI, suggesting that something was going to happen to the stocks on 11 September? Where does this information come from? And it's interesting because when he was actually going to be arrested, he had actually run out of his house and locked the door or something and gone somewhere, because he'd received a tip-off from people in the FBI that was going to happen. So we have this relationship which continues even after that, and so I thought that was very, very, again, it's not pure proof, you know, it's not going to stand up in court, but is it sufficient for us to say this needs to be investigated? Yes, you know.
Can you talk about the steps that George Bush's brother took prior to September 11th?
Yeah, Jeb Bush, he, I think it was on the 7th September or 9th September, I can't remember, but he signed, he had these executive orders prepared several months ago in the summer of 2001, basically which would implement martial law in Florida. And it was literally a few days before 9/11 that he actually signed those and implemented martial law. And the specific text of the executive orders talks about bringing out the National Guard in the case of a national emergency. So for some reason, Jeb Bush thought that there was going to be a national emergency literally a few days before it actually happened. That's what seems to be the obvious implication. And him signing that order and having prepared these executive orders in summer does again suggest that people connected to Bush, the President Bush, had some kind of advance warning that something was going to happen. And it's interesting because there's a U.S. attorney called Tom Turnipseed who did a report. He interviewed this anonymous guy who was with the National Guard in D.C. And this guy basically said that they were holding it normal. They have their normal drills and stuff during the summer, and everything was suddenly put on hold in the middle of summer, and they were told to prepare for a new kind of drill which would occur on the date was 14th of September, and they were told basically they wouldn't do anything else normal apart from prepare for that, and they would expect a phone call around the end of August telling them to that you have to be prepared now to come out. I think it was I read the report on Common Courage. I think it was Common Courage News Service or something like that. It's a kind of alternative thing. And because he's an attorney, I thought it was a very credible source. And I think those things, you put them together, you find that there is this certain elements of various agencies in the States did seem to be being put on a state of alert in advanced warning that some kind of emergency was going to happen. You know, people were preparing for it, and now we've had bits of this slowly being leaked out by people involved.
You've been listening to Nafiz Ahmed, author of War on Freedom, published by Tree of Life Publications. My colleague Audrey Burns and I interviewed Mr. Ahmed in Brighton, England in February 2003. Coming to you from the trenches, this is Tom McClurg.
We're very pleased to conclude the program with a talk by Stan Goff, a former U.S. Special Forces officer turned peace activist, whose insightful articles we've read on the air in the past. This talk was delivered in August at the National Convention of Veterans for Peace.
I spent a long time in the Army. I'm a slow learner, y'all. I was within 5 years of my retirement before I started getting a real clear picture of what it was I'd been involved in for two decades. And I think it's important for us to understand, you know, to make sure that we're fueled by our moral outrage, but it's also important for us to understand how this system works so that we can understand better how to go disrupt it. And I want to talk a little bit about that too, because I think the people in this room right now have a special role in that kind of political disruption that's really necessary right now, because we're living under a regime right now that's on an incredibly dangerous and destructive path, not just for people in other parts of the world, but for us and for the planet in general. This is one of the most frightening administrations we've seen in a long time. And that's saying something at the end of a century of arch criminals who've run this country. So anyway, I was in the Army for quite a while, starting in Vietnam and ending my career. My last deployment was into Haiti in 1994, about which I've written a book that Dennis just came up and said, I've got to flog these books and get as many of you as I can to buy some so I can pay for my plane ticket out here. you'll see those things laying around. I worked in 8 conflict areas, but I did not always work as a direct combatant. And that's an important thing to understand, is that the United States has sort of two different ways of employing the military. And one of those ways is through the community that I was part of for a long time, which is Special Operations Community. Our job was not so much to go over there and act as combatants, but to do the type of things that some of the Vietnam veterans here will remember back when the MAG was organized, and you're working in an advisory and assistance role to try to push indigenous people out there to do all the things that we really don't want to, you know, when we don't want to get our hands wet. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of special forces and the embassies as extensions of the executive branch, and about the Rumsfeld Doctrine as it's currently being played out, so that we can get a little clearer picture of what's going on right now in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Colombia, and some other places. I will say, you're talking about the paramilitaries in Colombia. I was in Colombia in 1992 as an advisor at Tolimata Air Base. I worked training the 1st and 2nd Colombian Special Forces Battalions down there in night operations as part of an ongoing program. And what's interesting is we were giving aid to them then, too. We would give the Colombian government money, which they in turn would pay back to the U.S. military to send advisors down there. So we paid ourselves via this circuitous, right? You got to follow the money sometimes to figure out how this stuff works. To come back in there and then give them training. So then we, you know, we buy all our gear with the money we give to the Colombians, and the Colombians gave back to us. 1991, a year before I went down there, there's a guy named Carlos Castaño. He's a pretty nasty character, and he was for years and years, until just here very recently, sort of in charge of this umbrella organization, the AUC, of all the paramilitaries in the country. In 1991, the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, assisted the Colombian government in integrating the staffs. Veterans will understand this. They integrated the staffs of the AUC with the Colombian military. So people that haven't been in the military don't understand what the integration of a staff means. What integration of a staff means is you've got the same command structure. It's the same organization. So the notion that we're going to get the Colombian military to turn around and attack the AUC is like going into an infantry company, the United States Army, and say that you're going to have 1st Platoon attack 2nd Platoon. They're units in the same organization. And that's still true. Those staffs were coordinated. What they've done is developed an organization now where they can push the Colombian military out front into higher visibility positions and have them observe, just cursorily observe human rights norms that are established through international law, and allow the AUC to go out there and do all their wet work for them. And oh, by the way, we also have people like DynCorp and these other mercenary organizations that are now contracted to the Pentagon, to the Department of Defense, to go out and do the spraying and also provide close air support. Don't think they're not out there doing that. They're providing close air support for Colombian troops when they go up against the FARC and the ELN. These people are mercenary organizations. They're hired by the Pentagon. They're paid with the money that you and I give them in our taxes, but they are not subject to congressional oversight the same way that the U.S. military is. So they found all sorts of ways to sort of go around things. You know, and what DynCorp does now is they spray these micro-herbicides all over the ground. They don't just kill coca, they kill all the crops because it's a depopulation program. You see, they heard the old maxim from Mao that the people are the sea and the gorilla are the fish. Well, Castaño said, well, we'll just drain the ocean then. You know, so what they're doing is pushing entire peoples off their land for the purpose of gaining strategic access to it, both for economic development and because there is a fair amount of petroleum in Colombia right now. Petroleum is a very strategic mineral that's now peaked worldwide and going to become more and more rarefied as time goes on. And so gaining control of the world's energy resources, as we are trying to do now in Iraq, is going to be key to sort of moving forward in a larger geostrategic agenda the bosses in this particular country. I worked in as an advisor in various times in Panama, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, and then I went to Haiti in a sort of a different role. In fact, in Haiti, we developed some of the doctrines that are now being employed in Afghanistan, for instance, for the Special Forces Community. And in El Salvador and Guatemala, I worked directly under the supervision. You're always under the supervision of the MIL group at the U.S. Embassy, but it's important to understand the structure. I worked directly under the supervision of the U.S. Embassy when I was in Guatemala and El Salvador. So I really got, this sort of made my military career unique, because most military people don't really get that snapshot. They don't get to get inside that embassy and see how this direct representative of the U.S. executive branch is operating inside the country. And what they've got inside there, they've got something called a country team. You know, they've got all these sections, and each section has a head, and each of these heads get together as a country team every day and have a briefing. It's a staff briefing. You know, it's a staff meeting. And in the, you've got the old man as a rule, because men still tend to dominate the Foreign Service. You got the ambassador, and you'll have his or her deputy in there. And you'll have the econ section. You'll have the mail group. You have the security section. You have the consular section. You have the political section. Okay, just sort of get your head around that for a second. I'll go through and sort of describe what these are. The econ section is responsible. The guy in charge of the econ section, his job is to set up the relationship and maintain a relationship with the National Chamber of Commerce. I'm not joking about that. That's his job. He links up with the National Chamber of Commerce. Okay. Then there's the mill group. That's the military group. The mill group links up with the staff of the host country military. And you have the consular section that processes visas and passports and all that kind of stuff. You got the security section that runs the Marine security guards, runs the bodyguard details for the old man, and conducts all the investigation of all the indigenous folks they hire to come and work as office workers and guards and whatnot at the embassy. And then you've got the political section, which is a euphemism. The political section is the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay? Then all these people get together every day. And what was surprising to me was who was setting the agenda. You think, what, would it be the security section? Not the security section. Would it be the political section? This is a political entity. You think the political section was setting the agenda. But really, 9 times out of 10, the agenda was being set by the econ section. And this is where I had that moment where I said, aha, you know, this is about money. So that was my first experience, just sort of seeing how this thing runs, how the Foreign Service actually runs, how they build the direct relationships with their counterparts inside the host country. And then to understand, it's also important to understand that they work for the President of the United States via the Secretary of State. Okay? So when you've got a guy, you know, an intellectual mediocrity like George W. Bush, he decides who's going to represent the United States at these U.S. embassies. And whoever is working for him in the State Department is really carrying out those directives. So every U.S. embassy in the world right now is really doing what George Bush wants them to do, which means they're doing what Firth and Pearl and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all these other people want them to do, because that's the clique that's in power right now. That's a dangerous clique that's in power right now. And when you get into a place where there's the military gains ascendancy because they had to resort to military operation, then you get into a situation like Colombia or like Haiti. And there's sort of two parts to how you do that. And I'm being very extemporaneous, and I came in on a red eye, so if I'm stuttering, I apologize. But there's two parts to making sure this stuff works. One part is to make sure that the embassy does its job with all its sort of satellite agencies, and I'll talk about them in a minute. The other thing is, they got to get us to acquiesce to this stuff. You know, they have to. We don't have to support it. In fact, the majority of the people in the United States don't support any of this stuff because they don't even understand what's going on. You know, what they got to do is come up with some sort of an official story that's plausible enough to get us to turn our backs on it and just acquiesce. So we'll continue to pay our taxes and, you know, do all the stuff we've got to do, give them political support. You know. And stay quiet. You know, I've been here all to support the troops. You know what support the troops means? It means shut up. You know, they're telling us to shut up. You know, that's what support the troops. Man, my son's fixing to get on a plane tomorrow to go to Baghdad Airport. I'm not going to shut up. I am supporting, you know. So, but that's what they need, is they need our acquiescence. And to get that, they've got to come up with some sort of an official story. Official narratives, in every single case, only coincide with the truth incidentally. sometimes they coincide with the truth, if that works. But I mean, really, the purpose of these official narratives is to get us to say, okay, that's cool, we'll do it that way. And the official narrative, when I came of age, you know, and some of you look like you came of age even a little bit before I did, you know, was the world communist conspiracy. We had to go out there and stop this world communist conspiracy, you know, because if we didn't stop them, in Wade, they were going to be in Raleigh. You know what I mean? I mean, that was the story. And a lot of us believe that. Because they had us, you know, whipped up into a state of paranoia. Duh. I mean, you know, that's pretty familiar these days. And so that worked. Well, that didn't work. Now they've got this other thing. They talk about drugs. You know, when I was in Columbia, I was briefed by the PAO. That's Public Affairs Officer, for those of you who hadn't been in the military. I think most of you have. So the PAO told us when we went through Fort Clayton in Panama to process in the theater, here's the official story. This is the official story. You are down there to provide counter-narcotics assistance. I'd never seen a picture of a drug lab. Wouldn't know a drug lab if it bit me in the ass. I don't know anything about drugs. I'm not a cop. I was never a cop. You know? At the same time, we got the briefing, the PAO said you're supposed to go down there and assist in the counter-narcotics efforts. They also told us what our real mission was, and that was to develop a counterinsurgency capability. Our job was to go down there and beef these people up, partly because their officer corps was one of the most corrupt and venal institutions that I've ever seen anywhere. And that's saying something, because I've been to Guatemala and El Salvador, too, you know, where thief is a synonym for an officer in the military, you know. But that was our job, was to beef up their capability to go out there and not just beset these guerrillas, but to beset all these people that were identified as guerrillas, the sea that they had to drain, you know. So they had to have the official story. It was drugs. Well, now the drug thing is wearing off, and in fact, it was sort of losing traction because even members of the dominant class in the United States started to question this whole drug war because it seemed like we were losing it. And the harder we fought it, the more we lost it. I mean, what happens to a commodity whenever you start making it harder to get? You run the price up and the profit margins go, what kind of a war is that? Where every time you win a battle, you empower your enemy. It don't make any sense, right? You know, but I mean, that wasn't why we were there, and we knew that. You know, that's the interesting thing, is a lot of times soldiers, especially folks in special operations, know that better than most of the public, because we're the ones who are required to understand the lie and live with the lie. You know, it also means that we're exposed to a lot of subversive influences, and I'll talk about that in a little bit too. I was talking to Tim earlier about that. Now, you know, in July 2001, the Pakistani embassy was noted. This is July 2001. The Pakistani embassy had already been notified that there was probably going to be a military incursion into Afghanistan sometime around October. This is well before September 11th. Okay. Then, all of a sudden, September 11th, boom, you know, everything blows out. Now, I'm not buying any conspiracy theories and claiming Bush presidency said it. I don't believe that, you know. But I really do believe that inside that administration, when they got out of the public eye, where they go out there and wring their hands and, you know, pretend how sorry they were and all this stuff, they were back there going, thank you, God. You know, because this was a gift from Santa Claus to this administration. This allowed them to step on the accelerator for this very creepy, very dangerous agenda that they're involved in moving forward on right now. Back to the embassies, and again, I apologize for sort of rambling all over the place. There's some other stuff about embassies that people need to understand. This is something that I picked up on when I was in Haiti. And one of the things I learned in Haiti is something that some of these lads and lasses are learning about right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's the role of an occupier? Because the role of an occupier is a little bit different than the role of a combatant. Sometimes it means you're a combatant too, you know, as it does around Fallujah and places like that right now. But it also means, again, that you're directly exposed, I mean, glaringly exposed to the hypocrisy of these official narratives. And one of the things that I learned about, you know, well, let's talk about Haiti. Haiti, we didn't have any drugs to go after. And there were no communists in Haiti. And, gosh, let's see, there were no terrorists in Haiti. And there's no oil in Haiti. What in the world were we going to Haiti for? You know, what was all that about? We already had, you know, we already had this brutal outfit installed. They'd already overthrown Aristide with the assistance of the U.S. Embassy, and I can talk about that in a minute. 1991, now all of a sudden in 1994, we got to throw all these guys out. Because sometimes our creatures begin to develop an independent streak, like the Noriegas and whatnot, or the Bin Ladens, and they have to be demobilized. And sometimes they're so awful that they create a form of popular democracy that says we're not going to be contained by an electoral process, and we're going to take matters into our own hand. And that's what was going on in Haiti around 1993. They'd already thrown Baby Doc out just 5 years before, you know, and threw him out by force, ran him out of town on a rail, flew out on a C-130 so he could go live on the left bank in Paris, you know, in his golden parachute. But he had to get out of town quick. And I love Haiti, so sometimes whenever I start talking about it, I get, you know, sort of maudlin. But Haitian people were the second successful revolution in this hemisphere. In 1804, they won their independence from a slave rebellion. First independent black nation in the world is Haiti. These people have, and everyone in Haiti, down to little bitty children, know about this. You know, they know that their situation is punishment. It's punishment for being a black nation that won its independence from a slave rebellion, because that reverberated throughout the whole continent. In fact, Bolivar was very interested in the history of Toussaint Louverture. You know, and these people were on the upswing again. That's what the Cedras administration that we had to throw out in 1994 and replace Aristide with, or replace him with Aristide after we had, you know, maneuvered behind the scenes. Not we. It wasn't us that did it. It was them, you know, people up in D.C., people with the State Department, people with the military. I'm sorry, I won't get off on too much of a tangent. Hey, but something's going on in Haiti right now that's not being done with military intervention. In fact, there was so much resistance that we pulled our troops back out of Haiti again. Did you know that? Popular resistance removed the U.S. military from Haiti. Slowly, but it happened over time. I've been back there 9 times since I was down there during the intervention. But it was like, they were just not going along. Haitian people are rebellious, y'all. You know? And that's what was about to happen. We didn't go back in there to remove Cedras. We went in there to remove Cedras and Francois because they were becoming a catalyst for another potential revolution that had nothing to do with oil. It had to do with geopolitics, because Haiti's right there. If Haiti does it again and gets away with it, there's people thinking about this in Puerto Rico, in Jamaica, you know, it's right there. They're thinking about it in Venezuela now. You know, you can't allow an example like that, like Nicaragua. You can't allow an example like that to exist in the region. Now, one of the things that they do through the embassy is they've got some other agencies in there, United States Agency for International Development, the National Endowment for Democracy, and in this political section. And the USAID does really neat things. They go out and build wells. They come up with, you know, classrooms for children, all sorts of little tiny projects on their face seem to be very beneficial. But what they do is they bring money in and they buy off the cream of that nation's indigenous intelligentsia and remove them from the larger political equation. It's a way to co-opt them, you know. That's what they do. That's the USAID. And the USAID takes its instructions from the political section, which is the Central Intelligence Agency. They prioritize where they need to go and what projects they need to develop in order to bleed off these people who can act as potentially subversive leadership. And the other thing, this is, and I'll just close with this because I don't want to monopolize the title here. If there's any one agency that everyone should study in order to understand U.S. foreign policy as well as it can be understood, read up on the National Endowment for Democracy. The National Endowment for Democracy is a front organization. It's a front foundation through which we funnel money to determine the outcomes in advance of other people's elections. We funnel money into political organizations. The NED was people who funnel money into the anti-Chavez so-called strikes in Venezuela. They were the people that are still involved with trying to bring down the Haitian government because they feel like the wrong people are in charge there. So if you don't learn anything else from here, go back, do a web search, go down to the library and learn what you can about the National Endowment for Democracy, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, the people like us, you know, people like what I used to be, we get called in when that process fails. When that process fails, then we got to resort to the gun. You know, but what they really want is they want this facade of democracy. And the facade of democracy is elections. Because you can go back afterwards. No matter how much you manipulate that process, like they did with UNO in Nicaragua and other places, no matter how much you manipulate that process, once you have the elections, and you can get the right people to come in and genuflect over it and say, we were observers and it was a fair election. Nobody's talking about how those particular candidates were selected. It's kind of like we have here. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So there's, yeah. And I'm sorry for my lack of coherence, but I'm just going to throw some of that stuff out there and again say that, you know, again, our moral outrage is great gasoline, but knowledge about how this stuff works is a steering wheel. So if we're gonna make this thing go, you know, we also have to understand our enemy right now. And I want to make sure that I cede the floor to this gentleman over right here. And thanks for your attention.
And that was former Special Forces Officer Stan Goff speaking last month in San Francisco at the Veterans for Peace Convention. Thanks to the L.A. Sound Posse for that recording. On Friday, September 12th, the Rochester Social Forum will begin, and it will run through Saturday, the 13th. The Social Forum is being held in solidarity with the protests against the World Trade Organization that will be occurring in Cancun, Mexico. For more information on the Rochester Social Forum, visit metrojustice.org on the web or call area code 585-325-2560. That's area code 585-325-2560. Father Daniel Berrigan will be in Ithaca September 19th through 21st. He'll be giving two talks, one on September 20th at 7:30 p.m. in Barnes Hall. The other will be a sermon on September 21st in Sage Chapel. A weekend celebrating peace activism has been organized in his honor, including an incredible music festival on the Arts Quad at Cornell on September 20th from 2:30 to 7 p.m. There will be various events, all free and open to the public. These events are being sponsored by the Center for Ethics, Religion, and Social Policy, CRESP, at Cornell. For more information on the Daniel Berrigan Weekend, visit CRESP's website at www.sas.cornell.edu/CRESP. www.sas.cornell.edu/CRESP. Or visit their office in Annabelle Taylor Hall. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us through our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Just like